When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, you are listening to Proverbs with Daisy Maskell. It is me, Daisy. Welcome. This is a podcast all about extraordinary people and extraordinary stories. Here we will shine the spotlight on their journeys and hopefully learn something about ourselves and the way that we live our lives from their experiences too. Join me for the next half an hour as we get to know our guest. Hello, how you doing? I'm really excited for this week's episode, you know. We're going to be joined by Chris Lemons, who you may know as the star of the Netflix documentary Last Breath. He was diving off the coast of Ireland when he got cut off from his oxygen supply and he was left completely stranded and alone at the bottom of the ocean. As I said, I'm a massive fan of his documentary. It's one that I put absolutely everyone onto. He seems like such a genuine and inspirational guy as well. Let's meet him.
Thank you so much for being here, Chris. This is an absolute honour.
Oh, not at all. It's my honour's all mine, really. Thank you so much for inviting me. Very kind of you.
Oh, you're such an amazing guy. I mean, I first heard about your story through watching the doc on Netflix. I've watched it many a times. I think the first time I saw it was actually on a plane. The sea is something that fascinates me. And I think being a diver is a dream job for a lot of kids growing up too. How on earth did you get into this?
I sort of fell into it, really, yeah. It is an unusual sort of line of work, isn't it? And there's a sort of the dream of it, and then there's a reality, of course, like many jobs. But if you've seen the film, there's Dave and Duncan, who are were my sort of partners in crime on the day. They both got into diving through, they had a passion for it before. Dave was a scuba diver out in Thailand, and Duncan sort of is a bit older, grew up watching Jacques Cousteau and things like that on the TV, and they both found a way really to make their passion, their vocation, really. But for me, it wasn't really the case. I was just, pretty young and completely unsure as to what to do with my life. And I just got the opportunity, really, for a summer job of sorts. You know, just a bit of pocket money. A friend's father got me a job working on the back deck of one of these boats, what we call a dive support vessel. So I got to sort of see firsthand, in a way, and it was a job, unlike a lot of people, I didn't really know very much about it. I didn't really know that it existed particularly. But it was fascinating to watch. And I think as soon as I saw them, and, there's some truth in the fact that they probably turned up in better cars than me on the quayside as well. It sort of lit the touch paper for me. And I realized, what I wanted to do in my life. It gave me some direction, which was fantastic in itself.
I think not only does the film obviously tell your story, but it really shows the dedication and the training and how fit and how experienced you guys really are before you even take your first dive. How long did the average dive, or does the average dive take you, Chris? How long are you usually under for?
I think that's a bit flattering, by the way, but thanks anyway. the particular type of diving I do is called saturation diving, which is a very unusual way of diving, really. But that's designed really to allow you to spend a long time on the bottom. So I work almost exclusively these days in the North Sea, and we're regulated that we're only allowed to spend 6 hours a day in the water. So that's what we do, usually about 6 hours actually in the water, which is normally on the seabed, walking around in a pair of yellow wellies. But sometimes we're swimming. But yeah, 6 hours is the limit, thankfully.
6 hours. See, to me, obviously with zero diving experience, that seems like a long time to be underwater. Yeah. And you're saying you're walking along the seabed as well, which is what I found particularly fascinating too. Chris, when you set out on this particular dive, were you concerned about the conditions beforehand, the weather? Did you sense that anything was going to go wrong?
No, far from it. It was probably the reverse, actually. It was... I normally say it's just, it felt very much like a normal day at the office, as much as working on the bottom of the North Sea can ever be normal. But, it's something we do all day, every day. The weather conditions are maybe, the weather you see in the film is probably slightly exaggerated, but it was pretty rough. But that's fairly normal for working out there. If you couldn't work in those conditions, then we'd never get anything done, really. But no, it was pretty, the visibility was quite clear, which is unusual. We were doing a job that day or a task that day that we were pretty familiar with. So no, not, no sense at all of what the what was to come, really.
And I wouldn't have gone otherwise. This is a thing though, isn't it? This is exactly the thing. Walk us through what it's like diving down to a seabird, Chris, because I cannot visualise this whatsoever. What are the conditions like? Can you see anything? What is it like when you hit the floor? Because it must be such a disorientating experience.
Yeah, that's a very good way of describing it. Disorientating is exactly what it is a lot of the time. I mean, it can be very variable. There are sort of magical days when the water is beautifully clear, and we go down in a diving bell, and that's usually sort of sits about 10 meters off the seabed, and you jump off the diving bell and sort of float down to the seabed, and it can all feel quite magical, you know, a little bit like being what you imagine maybe being a spaceman would be like, you know, although obviously they're much better qualified than we are. But yeah, it's a strange environment. It's got an ethereal sense to it. It's you know, it's very quiet. Normally the way that we breathe I won't bore you with the details, but basically it's we don't sort of have bubbles flying out of our helmets or anything like that. It's actually a very quiet place to be. But yeah, a lot of the time it's very dark. We work at night a lot of the time, but generally, particularly when we go deeper than sort of 50, 60 meters, it's completely dark. So yeah, times it can be lovely, but you know, I'll probably say 80% of the time it's actually fairly miserable, because it can be muddy and you can barely see your hand in front of your face and very easy to get lost. And it's quite, you know, the diving part of it is probably the easy part in a way. It's the sort of the stress and the pressure, like any job really, of performing in that environment really. So yeah, there's good days and bad days, I guess, like any job.
And you're attached to your vessel by what you call an umbilical cord, basically. What is the purpose of this?
It's exactly what it sounds like. Yeah, it is our giver of life, really. So the bell, the diving bell, has a sort of large umbilical which comes down to it, and then it splits three ways. We have we go down in teams of three. One diver always stays in the diving bell every day, and then the other two drop down to the seabed to work. That's sort of roles that we change every day. But yeah, the umbilical splits and goes to each diver and basically provides breathing gas. So we breathe, because of the depths we're working at, we can't breathe air. So we breathe what's called heliox, which is a mixture of helium and oxygen, which means, and often when you're very deep, you can be breathing as little as sort of 2-3% oxygen in certain sort of certain situations, purely because the pressures involved mean that same volume of gas is, you know, it's the same as the equivalent of breathing 21% on the surface. So it gives you an endless supply of gas, really. And then it also provides you with hot water. We wear quite a loose fitting wetsuit down on the bottom, water gets pulled out of the sea and warmed on the ship, and then pumped down to us to sort of pour through our suit to keep us warm, because it can be, you know, 3 or 4 degrees Celsius down there. It also gives you electricity to provide light for a hat and power for a camera on your helmet. And then, as I said, instead of breathing our bubbles out, the gas that we breathe out is sucked back up to the ship and recycled, basically, because heliox is a very expensive commodity, really. So they try and reuse it. They clean it and add a bit of oxygen and send it back down to us, really. Yeah. So, yeah, it's everything you need to survive in what are, you know, obviously fairly harsh conditions.
It's your lifeline. I remember you speaking with this heliox in the documentary, and you were saying it makes you speak with a very high voice, but after about 30 seconds, the laughs are over and you sort of get your job done and you're over it. But
yeah, you know, yeah, it is. It does. It makes you sound very stupid. Yeah. And I think I said that in the documentary, but yeah, it's funny for 5 minutes. Yeah. But it's when you're having to do anything, like, you know, ring the bank manager or speak to people at home, it's actually very frustrating, because it's not just the silly voice. It's also when you're very deep and you live under pressure, you know, so I think your vocal cords basically get constricted as well, and you can be almost unintelligible when you're very deep, yeah, which is a real pain, to be honest.
That umbilical is your absolute lifeline, Chris. I feel like you've summarized that up. You've really stressed on the importance of that. On the diving question, things above the water start to go wrong. Your crew were losing control of the vessel due to the weather, and you're told to abort this mission. Were you nervous at this point at all, or was this a common occurrence? I'm guessing you were sort of trained for things to go a little bit wrong and for you to have to leave a mission and go back up to the vessel. So did panic set in at this point, or did you think that everything was sort of under control.
It wasn't really the weather that caused the problem. It was basically a computer system which holds the vessel in one place that failed. But yeah, we sort of heard alarms in our helmets, but even that in itself is not unusual. Exactly as you say, you know, little things do happen occasionally. There are technical problems and we will have to, you know, come back to the diving bell for whatever reason. And we can also hear, we've got a sort of direct line of communication to a dive supervisor up on the ship, and we can hear everything he's saying and everything that's going on in the background as well, which is usually people, you know, slating divers, to be honest. But yeah, it was, I think it made us, our ears prick up, you know, but there was definitely no panic at that point. We didn't even really know what was going on. And then our sort of dive supervisor, his name was Craig Frederick, and he's a Canadian guy. And he told us really just to get ourselves out of the structure we were working inside and back to the diving bell. But there was something in the tone of his voice which told us it wasn't a drill. It was fairly serious. But yeah, we certainly didn't panic at that point, no.
Like standard procedure just kicks in then, right? You guys are professionals, you guys know what to do, and I don't think anyone could really expect what happened next. Am I right in saying, Chris, as well, that umbilical is, gives you a good sense of direction too?
Yeah, it's not so much direction, but it's your, when you're sort of scuba diving, for example, you know, you have always got the option of going to the surface. You know, it's never advisable to do that quickly, but that is always a possibility. But in the kind of diving we do, because our, not boring you with the physics and the biology really, but your tissues are effectively saturated with inert gases. If you were to go to the surface, it would mean, you know, a pretty instant death from explosive decompression, really. So there is only one safe haven when we're diving, and that is the diving bell. That's the place you have to go to if there's any kind of a problem. And your umbilical is your guide back to that, really. You know, that's the thing you have to follow to get back there.
So your vessel starts to drift away now, Chris, and your cord has got you trapped. And this is a point where you start to notice, I don't know whether you start to notice tension in it, but your crew members certainly notice that there is a lot of tension that umbilical is under. What is going through your mind at this point in time? Because I'm guessing this is the point whereby you're realizing things are starting to go wrong.
Yeah, I definitely realized things were going wrong. I still don't think I had an appreciation of what was actually happening. It happened so very, very fast. Our umbilicals are only 50 meters long. And as you say, the boat was basically drifting away at the mercy of the wind and the waves above. And my umbilical got caught on a transponder bucket, which is just a metal outcrop, really. The film sort of belies how quickly it happens, really. I think that video is looped in the film a bit, and it's just very, very fast. But I wasn't thinking much at all. It's just complete fight or flight. I was thrashing around trying to free it, really. But it tightened very, very fast indeed. I mean, effectively at that point, I'd become, you know, the anchor on the end of an 8,000 ton vessel. There's only going to be one winner in that situation. But you're right, Dave, who was in the water with me, he sort of turned to try and get back to me. He realized my umbilical had caught, and he could sense the, you know, the enormous tension starting to come on it. Unfortunately for him and for me, that he was, you know, he was at the end of his 50 meters of umbilical, if you like, and was only able to get to within you know, a couple of meters of me.
Oh, that is so heartbreaking. That moment right there of realizing he's at the end of his cord and he can basically do nothing. What are you signaling towards each other? Could you, obviously you can see each other, could you sense fear in his eyes? What were your feelings towards each other in that moment?
I think my memory of it is that I think my communications cable, I think at that point internally, had stretched or snapped to the point that I'd lost the ability to speak to him. But we definitely had we both describe it in a similar fashion, really, that almost a cinematic moment when we were looking at each other, you know, in the eyes, and but unable to speak. And we can only really see each other's eyes through the faceplates. But his eyes were definitely saying, you know, I'm sorry, pal, you're on your own.
Yeah.
And mine were no doubt sort of pleading with him to try and help me. And then he was sort of pulled backwards. And I can remember losing sight of him, but still being able to see his light as he was dragged backwards and away off the roof of the structure. And then, you know, his light disappeared as well. And, you know, I never saw him again, unfortunately. Well, until later.
Until after. Thank God. Thank God.
Yeah, spoiler, see, I do make it.
I was gonna say this at the start of this episode, because the biggest cliffhanger in the film on Netflix is you don't appear until the end, and I can't tell you how much I cried. I did watch it for the first time on a plane, and I think a lot of the passengers were sort of looking around at me, wondering what was going on. I know you're more emotional on a plane anyway, but the story was just so incredible, and I feel like this episode, a load of people will go and watch it, no doubt. The film on Netflix after, but we've given away the biggest cliffhanger, because
I know, I'm sorry,
you're here.
I've been dying. I've never been on a plane yet where it's been on. I've been dying to be on one, you know, and catch somebody watching, you know, and just stick my head around the corner and say it does make it. Yeah, but yeah, I also wasn't sure whether that would work in the film, whether it was people, they would be able to sell the fact that I don't, you know, I possibly don't make it, you know, but it does seem to work. Yeah,
so your umbilicals snapped, Chris, and you've seen your crew member basically slip away into the darkness. Is your bellman was Duncan, am I right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, Duncan's a great guy. I really like Duncan. he basically pulls up your umbilical cord, and I'm guessing he's praying that you're going to be on the end of it, and you're not. Do you know the impact that had on him as he shared his experiences of that time?
Yeah, so Duncan, as you say, exactly that. Duncan is exactly as he comes across in the film. He's a very deeply lovely man, and he'd been a sort of a father figure to me, I guess, in my career, you know, at least. I was in the infancy of that. I'd been a diver for a long time before that, but that particular kind of diving I'd only been doing for about a year and a half, and a lot of that time had been spent with Duncan mentoring me effectively, and we hung out at each other's houses back at home and been to parties together and things like that, so we'd grown pretty close, and we spent a lot of time in people's company and that type of work. So obviously the umbilical had snapped at that point, and he had to pull in a, you know, himself sort of slightly unaware really of what was happening. It didn't feel natural to him pulling that umbilical in. And he was worrying, you know, first of all, he wasn't sure what he was going to get, because there's all sorts of scenarios. You know, he was even going to get what he did get, which was a, you know, pretty tattered, broken hoses, or he was going to get a helmet on the end of it with no head in it, or he was going to get a helmet with a head in it, you know, and all of those were pretty bad outcomes. Yeah. To talk about trauma a little bit, I mean, it's funny how it affects people differently, or what happened affect people differently. I personally don't feel that I've suffered in any way at all, really. I don't know if that's partly because, you know, when you're directly involved with something, it's sometimes a bit easier. And I suppose I've had the cathartic process of telling a story many times and talking to people about it. But a lot of people had to witness it that night. Not so much Duncan, although, you know, he definitely gets emotional about it still. But a lot of people, you know, we have 110 people on that boat just to put three divers on the seabed. And a lot of those people had to watch everything in real time on screens around the boat. And there's some pretty harrowing footage in the film. And some of that lasts, you know, 30, 35 minutes in real life. And they would have been watching, you know, a colleague, and hopefully at least for one or two of them, a friend supposedly dying. And that must have been very, very hard. And there's certainly people, you know, the ROV pilot, for example, decided never to work with divers again. And a lot of people had sleepless nights since, you know. Yeah.
Wow. You had some gas in a reserve tank, didn't you, Chris, which was intended to get you back to a boat, but it was very, very limited. How conscious were you of this, of your limited air supply and what you had left?
Yeah, very conscious. Exactly as you say, we call that a bailout. So it's an emergency supply gas. But unfortunately, we were at 91 meters that night, I think. And you had two big bottles on my back, but you use those up very quickly at that depth because of the pressures involved. So I don't think I had a clear idea of how much I had in there. I knew at some point that I'd sort of fallen back to the seabed after the umbilical had broken and managed to climb my way back up to the top of this structure. I remember fully expecting to see people coming to rescue me, to see Dave or Duncan or somebody on their way to get me. But I got up there and saw nothing but, you know, complete and utter blackness in the sea above me. And I remember at that point having a little think about, you know, that's taken me 3 or 4 minutes to get up here. I've probably only got, you know, the film makes a big deal of 5 minutes, but it's probably more like nine if we do the maths properly. But, you know, I knew it was only maybe 3 or 4 minutes of gas left, which was a very strange thing, you know, particularly when I realized that even if Dave had been right in front of me at that point, ready to pull me back up to the diving bell, I mean, even then the margins would have been pretty fine in terms of getting me back into a breathable environment and taking my helmet off before I ran out of gas. So you know, you realise fairly quickly that the odds are massively against you getting out of this. But that in a weird way had a strangely calming effect, because, you know, the panic sort of subsided from it at that point, not because I'd lost hope, but because you realise there's not much point thrashing around and panicking anymore, because there was absolutely nothing I could do to help myself, really.
Yeah.
So sort of resignation and grief, I remember coming over me, and they spent a few strange, lonely minutes on the bottom, effectively counting down the seconds till I was about to die. Yeah.
How was time manipulated? It's interesting the way you speak about time as well, Chris, because there are certain moments that I can imagine went so fast, like the snapping of this cord or it getting trapped. But then I can imagine certain moments playing out cinematically as well, whereby time is almost dragging on and you've got sort of snapshots of the other diver that was with you slowly, slowly drifting away. How were you conscious of time, and how was time manipulated in that scenario?
Yeah, exactly right. I don't know if that's slightly exacerbated by the environment you're in. It's sort of got a cinematic nature to it anyway, and it's a strange, alien world to be in. But you're right. I mean, the first half, if you like, of my trying to rescue myself, I can remember that. Yeah, as you say, passing very, very quickly, and then subsequently, once I was almost sat there waiting for the end to come, it seemed to take a lot longer than I thought it would. You know, it seemed like long minutes. The truth is, we'll never really know how long that was, and we can do the maths, but there are a lot of variables in terms of how quickly I breathed and things like that, so we'll never really know, and we've got no record of when I actually fell unconscious. But yeah, you're exactly right. It was strange sort of move in time, and even to this day, it's when I think back to it, it seems very surreal. There's no doubt about that. And I remember it feeling surreal at the time, you know, almost reverting back to being the little boy or the little, you know, the little girl that's inside all of us, really. We haven't really grown up, have we, in truth? And, you know, feeling bewildered, really, and just astonished that I'd found myself in this position and that I was going to die in a strange and lonely place. How on earth has this happened?
Continuing the conversation on Proverbs after this short break.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Does it feel like a memory, Chris?
Yeah, definitely. That's a good way of putting it. And it's hard because you tell a story a lot. And I feel like I've got a very vivid recollection of what happened. But just to give you an example, you know, I would have been extremely cold very, very quickly because I'd lost my hot water. You know, pretty much hypothermically cold pretty fast. But I don't have any particular recollection of being cold, you know. So that tells you one of two things. Either that, you know, the body is very capable of shutting off unnecessary senses, I guess, or that my memory of things is not quite what I think it is. I'm not as lucid as I remember. So yeah, it does take on a dreamlike quality, the memory of it. And the weird thing obviously is that we've got a lot of it on film, and thus they made the film. So you try, it's hard after, you know, that's, you know, it's 2012 this happened, so you know, we're knocking on the door 10 years ago now, and you know, you wonder how much of your memory is the film and how much is your actual memory, if you know what I mean.
I was shocked about how much footage was included in the film, actually. Even the footage that you sort of filmed in a vlog style as well. I know it was back in 2012, but I feel like you were kind of ahead of your time in doing that, and you were sort of documenting your life, you know, as a diver and on board a vessel and being out at sea, which you were really able to document how isolating that can be sometimes. But I think the footage in the film that you managed to capture and that was captured of the event as well was just incredible. I really didn't expect that.
Yeah, I mean, that's really why the film got made, as I said. I mean, they had the sort of the documentary makers, they had the, you know, the Holy Trinity, really. They had the protagonists all alive, I guess, and willing to talk as well. And then all this, yeah, as you say, all this raw footage. So I'd say I think 90% of the film, the footage you see in a film, is the real thing. There are places we don't actually record. I'm probably blowing the director's secrets here, but yeah, there's some of the footage in the chamber, for example, that's not the real thing, because we don't actually record that. But they did come and record us at work, so it's sort of semi-genuine, but it wasn't from the night. But yeah, that's the thing, that's what makes it so powerful, is that it's the real thing you're seeing. Yeah,
it really is. So above the water, Chris, your crew, they're working hard to rescue you, although at this point the ship has pretty much lost control. I remember it being basically compared to a sailboat drifting, and your crew decided to control it manually, which is am I right in saying that's only really used in a harbour with no wind, and at this point you're in the North Sea in not the greatest conditions?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so it's what's called a dynamic positioning system. That's just the thing that normally is controlled by a computer and holds the boat in one single position so that we can work on the seabed. And that had failed. And so, yeah, they were sort of found themselves on the bridge of the boat with all their screens blacked out. It was the middle of the night. Well, it was 10 o'clock at night, so it was completely dark in September. And they had no frame of reference. We weren't working anywhere near an oil rig or anything like that to give them orientation. So they were in a very, very difficult position with exactly, as you say, a system that was, they get a little bit of stick for not having controlled the boat, but they were basically in an impossible position because, as you say, it's designed to nudge it into a quay wall in a harbour. It's not designed to be used in anger. And it took two of them to control four joysticks and try and coordinate that. Very, 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 very difficult thing to do, yeah.
We spoke a little bit about the footage from that day that was captured, and I think the most powerful bit of footage was when they finally had eyes on you made it back to the platform, as you said, and they said they were getting ready to send a diver down, but they had eyes on you at the time, so they knew exactly where you were, and they said that you appeared to be waving. How did it feel to watch that footage back of you, Chris? Because even as, you know, a viewer, I found that so powerful and so emotional. That's the image that really sticks in my mind.
Yeah, it does mine. It's probably the rawest bit of the film, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I wasn't waving, by the way. That's sort of unconscious movement, I think. I'm definitely unconscious at that point. But yeah, so basically the ship ended up being nearly 250 metres away from where I was. And they were, you know, there's a snail trail of how they were trying to control the boat. And it's like Spaghetti Junction. They just weren't managing. But what they did have on board is what we call an ROV, which is a remotely operated vehicle, which is a flying camera, basically. And that had a very long tether. So they were able to find me with that. And that sort of harrowing footage that you see is what I'm talking about, because that you know, you see maybe a few minutes, you know, a couple of minutes there in the film, but that footage goes on for sort of 35 minutes while you wait for the boat to come back under control and for Dave to turn up. And I'm sort of twitching unnaturally, but after maybe 10 minutes to that, the twitching stops and I go, you know, I go completely still, and they would all have assumed the worst at that point, you know, fair enough. But yeah, for me watching it back, the mechanics of what we do means that even after the accident, we had to spend 4 days decompressing within the chambers, and then eventually we were sort of released into the wide world. And the first thing we do was sort of congregate in a little office on the ship and watch that footage ourselves. They were like, oh, come and see this. it's surreal. You feel like a third party. I feel like anybody else watching it, I think. I don't really see it as me in a strange way, you know. I wonder if he's going to make it, I think.
Yeah. Do you remember, Chris, comforting yourself? What were you doing to comfort yourself as you were laying there until you eventually fell unconscious?
So it's a wide range of emotions. I mean, I wouldn't pretend I wasn't worrying about myself, because I definitely was, you know. you don't want to die, but... Yeah, I remember thinking mostly about the people at home, you know, the enormous damage that was going to be done to those that, you know, I'm lucky enough have loved me, I guess. I was at a point in my life where I was, you know, excited. I was 32 or something like that. And, getting married the following year, and we were in the process of building a house, and, you know, exciting times of our you know, our and my future and all the hopes and dreams that go with that ahead of me. So, yeah, I remember really thinking that that's all about to be snatched away from me. And I remember envisaging my fiance at the time being told the news, and, you know, my mother being told, and, you know, I remember thinking about really stupid practicalities, like, you know, we're actually going to get into the online banking, you know, ridiculous stuff, really, you know. Yeah, so it was weird. I was weirdly, calm's probably the wrong word, but I definitely wasn't, there was no panicking. It was very somber.
So the vessel now has eyes on you, Chris, and they manage somehow to regain control of it. They're heading back to you, and then they send out a diver to come and save you. I'm guessing you have absolutely no recollection of this, and you've only just really seen the footage that they managed to capture.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the crew on the boat are Norwegian. So they call this the Swedish solution, which we're all familiar with, which is they basically turn the computer off and they turn it back on again. You know, the Swedish call that the Norwegian solution.
That's some mum advice right there as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, so they did. They managed to regain control and move the vessel back to me. And once they were within, you know, they basically put the diving bell directly over me, and they lowered it right down to make Dave, who was still in the water, hadn't got out of the water. He was able, you know, to make his job of recovering me as easy as possible. But yeah, I'm the same as you. I've no memory of that at all. And I've just seen it on telly. But he basically drops down. We're sort of negatively buoyant, so we're weighted because we're working on the seabed. But we do have a jacket which we can inflate to make ourselves buoyant and easy to climb up and things. So normally if Dave had been rescuing me, he would have inflated my jacket and inflated his own and made his life a lot easier to pull me back. But mine had been severed, you know, my air supply or gas supply had been severed, so he wasn't able to use mine. And what he did with his own was took it off and put the hose up what we call our neck dam, which is a rubber seal that goes around our necks to sort of, you know, that the helmet locks onto to keep the water out, and put that up there and turn the gas on to try and give me a bit of a breathing supply. And then he attaches himself to me and hauls me back up towards the diving bell. And, you know, Dave is a seriously fit guy. He's a sort of rock climber fit. You know, he's got he's quite lightweight, but very, very strong. And you can see in the film how much he's struggling because the boat is moving up and down. There's 6 meters of sea above him. So the diving bell moving up and down sort of 5 or 6 meters all the time. That makes pulling, you know, I'm about six foot five, and I weigh probably more than I should. And, you know, gangly legs and all the rest of it. A really, really hard thing to do. So, you know, I think a lot of people really would not have managed that. He said to me himself that if he hadn't got me over the sort of the lip of the little stage beneath the bell on the last effort, he probably would have had to let me go and start again because he was close to exhaustion. So obviously it's an effort I can never thank him adequately for. Yeah. He's an amazing man and he's very, very, very humble about it all. But people often want to talk to me, which is lovely. But, you know, the truth is I was a damsel in distress in all this. And the real heroes are the guys who came to get me, you know, of which he was very much one of them. Yeah.
So, Chris, you were given a couple of breaths and you were brought back around by some absolute miracle. Thank God. What was your first thought when you regained consciousness? Did you remember? Did you realise what had happened? Did you know where you were?
Not really. I mean, that's when you watch the film, that's one of the bits we did have to recreate because there wasn't any footage of that. So that truth was probably more traumatic than anything that happened on the night. Was Duncan and I had to, we sort of recreated that in a place in Aberdeen, and he had to give me the kiss of life about 20 times in a row. And neither of us have ever really
lucky guy
recovered from that, to be honest. Yeah. But yeah, no, I describe it as a sort of slightly drunken sensation, I suppose. It was, I don't remember coming around, a vague memory of some flashing lights and things. Apparently I was able to climb back up into the bell myself, under my own steam and sit down. And I think I was acting as though nothing had happened. Almost, I was taking my gear off and doing what I normally would have done on the way back. Kind of oblivious, I think, to the, you know, certainly the magnitude of what had just happened. So, yeah, I've got a few flashes of coming back. The process of getting the diving bell back to the ship takes about 30 minutes, something like that. Mm. So I've got a few flashes. I remember seeing Dave crumpled in the corner, looking exhausted, and, you know, wondering why. And at some point, I think you see in a film, there's a bit of, you know, I could certainly grab Duncan's hand, and I think, you know, so obviously knew something had happened. But yeah, very vague memories of that part of things. Yeah.
You're very conscious of time when you're watching the film. I think there's even a little timer that basically counts how long you were actually under. All in all, Chris, how long were you under the water, separated from your umbilical cord and your oxygen supply?
from the moment the umbilical snapped to my helmet being taken off in the diving bell, I think was 41 minutes. The bit we don't know is how long my emergency supply lasted. So if you do the maths, you know, we have calculations for that, and you know, it works out at, I think, 9 minutes and 1 second. But as I said, there's that, you know, that could have been 7 minutes, it could have been 10 11 12. We really don't know. But yeah, whatever way you look at it, there's a massive discrepancy of time with nothing to breathe, you know. So yeah, I mean, to this day, really, it beggars belief, really.
Do you know what kept you alive, Chris?
I don't know. We've got quite a few theories. I did a talk of sorts with an intensive care conference last week, and that's probably as close as I've ever come in the 10 years since to some really good answers, you know, doctors and anaesthetists and all sorts pouring over it. I'd always assumed it was the cold. You know, you hear stories, don't you, of kids falling through ice and surviving for ridiculously long periods of time under the water. They use ice to cool patients in hospitals a lot. So we were talking about all of that, but they seem to think that may have been a factor. But in truth, it was almost certainly the gas I was breathing. So that day we were breathing, I think, on the bottom, what we call 6%. So that had 6% oxygen in it compared to the 21%, you know, you and I are breathing right now. Which obviously sounds, you know, if you were to breathe that on a surface, that would you'd be unconscious pretty quickly. But at that depth, that's actually quite high, an equivalent equivalency of quite a high pressure of oxygen. And then in the bailout, it was an even higher quantity again. So I think basically my, you know, to cut a long story short, my tissues had been saturated with oxygen, really, but just enough, you know, just enough to keep the individual cells alive. I often make the point that while the survival seems slightly miraculous, it's more the fact that I survived with, you know, well, at least no one's been brave enough to tell me otherwise yet, any sort of significant brain damage or anything like that. That seems more remarkable to me. But they're all sort of theories, as we say, and I've got a few other ideas. But, you know, the truth is we'll probably never really, really know the mechanics of how it all happened. Yeah.
Chris, I got to ask, how was it seeing your wife again for the first time after?
Yeah, emotional. Yeah. I can remember after it happened, I was pretty, I don't want to say blasé about it, but I didn't appreciate really the scale of what had happened. I remember I decided not to tell her. I thought, there's no point worrying her. You know, it's worrying enough having to send me off to work anyway, doing what I do. And I didn't want to have to panic or anything like that.
Why do partners always do that? My boyfriend would be exactly the same. He'd say, do you know what? I'm not going to tell her. And it makes you worry so much more.
Yeah, what else hasn't he told me? Yeah, of course. I know, I'm sorry. Yeah, I've grown up a bit since then, but yeah. But like I said, we have 4 days of decompression. And then I think after about a day and a half, you know, so we're all sat in this chamber waiting to get out, really. And my boss came over the intercom and said, you know, you might want to give her a call because it's going to be in the newspapers tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, even then, you know, so I rang her. I remember telling her in the third person, I sort of recounted the story in the third person. And I think, you know, towards the end of it, she guessed, you know, knowing what a catastrophe I am in general, that it was probably me who'd been, me who was involved. She got very emotional about it. You know, even though obviously I was fine. She sort of, I was saying, you know, stay at home, I'll be home soon, but she wouldn't do that. She drove pretty much straight to Aberdeen and was waiting at the end of the gangplank as soon as I got out. And yeah, it was probably seeing her that triggered a lot of emotions. You realize, you know, even more so the impact that it would have had on people. So yeah, it was a lovely moment. Yeah,
I know in the film you also said that you felt sad at first, or when you were sort of down at the bottom and you're about to fall unconscious, and then you said you were calm and it felt like almost falling asleep. And it was, this broke my heart, this moment, because it was almost like you were reassuring the rest of the crew. And it was interesting what you said earlier about how people deal with trauma, and sometimes the person that's actually going through it doesn't necessarily experience the highest amount of trauma, and it's the people that are around you that are either seeing it or that love you and care about you and worry about you that are impacted the most. And you're almost reassuring them that you were okay even after the event happened. How do you come back from accepting death like that, Chris? I don't know how. You must see the world so differently now.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you're 100% right about the trauma thing. You know, I think it's probably because those who have to witness it are powerless, aren't they, to a great extent. Talk to soldiers and things like that, who've witnessed their colleagues, you know, suffering life-changing injuries, and they've often suffered as much as the people directly involved for that reason. They're powerless and guilt and all the rest of it. You know, ultimately it's had a happy ending, so it's, you know, a lot of that's been healed, obviously. But yeah, I mean, for me, in terms of going, getting over it, I don't know, I didn't really feel I had much to get over because I was fine. I think the truth is you know, I don't know, maybe you're just a bit, you relativize it. I think at the time I was a bit younger, I was a bit more naive, I maybe had less responsibilities. I mean, I've got two daughters now and, you know, hopefully a bit older and a bit wiser. And I think I probably would do things differently now, whether I'd rush to go back to work, and I would probably definitely take more time to talk to the people at home about, you know, the impact that was going to have on them. Whereas, you know, what actually happened was I was, you know, probably a little bit selfish about it. I was worried. I remember being worried about my job, you know, the practicalities of paying a mortgage. And, you know, this is my career. Have I just blown my career? And they gave us the opportunity to come back, and we sort of, all three of us involved directly, grasped it with both hands and went back. But I think the truth is, it's like anything, you know, people ask, you know, have you had some kind of epiphany? And do you, as you touched on there, do you sort of see every day as a bright new one and be thankful for it? And there's some truth in that, but I like to think I was like that anyway.
Yeah.
But also reality also takes over, you know. You might feel like for a day or two, but then you've still got to, you know, take the bins out, or, you know, go and buy a pint of milk, and the life just takes over, and it's quickly forgotten, and you move on. And much of it was context, of course. People have near-death experiences all the time. You know, you might walk in front of a car and, you know, it just misses you, you know. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, if that hit me, that would have been game over, you know. And that's, yeah, in a weird way, the same thing. But mine obviously happened in a slightly strange, unusual environment, and also had the luxury of time really to reflect on it. So that's the reason it was a bit different. But yeah, I think you just that's just how life is. You move on. And it seemed like such a freak accident that I don't really envisage it happening again. And I can't really speak for Duncan and Dave, but for me, in a weird way, it's been a positive experience in my life. It's been a learning experience. It's brought lots of opportunities in a strange way. I don't regret it happening, if that's that doesn't sound too blasé, you know. But obviously I wish it hadn't. But, you know, but mostly for the others, you know, for me, it's been, I think the fact that we extricated ourselves from what was a seemingly impossible situation, that in itself, just in terms of work, has been a confidence building thing, you know. In a weird way, we go back a bit more confident that we can do that kind of thing, get ourselves out of the impossible, were it ever to happen again, you know.
Life works in weird and wonderful ways, and it puts you in situations sometimes whereby at the time they don't seem great, but once you get out of it, it really does show you how strong and how amazing you are. And I saw, am I right in saying also that you went back on another dive 3 weeks later after this happened? You were straight back to work.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, you're right, because I'm not an amazing human being, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. I'm very much average. So, but it just goes to show we as human beings, as a species, are remarkably resilient and capable of surviving incredible things, isn't it? You know, but yeah, they did. They gave us the choice to go back 3 weeks later, so we were sort of shut down by the health and safety executive body, investigating what happened and rectify the problem, obviously. But yeah, then as a team of three, we took the decision just to get straight back on the horse, really. And we went back together to the same place, in fact, and carried on the same job 3 weeks later. We the first job we did was took off the metal outcrop that caught my umbilical. That was job number one. And then we sort of carried on.
There you go.
As normal, yeah. I mean, it was weird. We sort of laughed and joked, and there was a bit of nerves. But strangely, as soon as we were in the water, you know, the nature of the job takes over, really, and you forget you're in the water most of the time anyway, and you just get on with what you're doing. And it was quite quickly forgotten. They don't let me forget it. To this day, I get reminded about it every time I'm in the water, and some comedian above me will make a comment. But yeah, for us, strangely, it was fine. Yeah.
You still dive today, Chris, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I'm just in the process of stopping. So I've decided to train as a supervisor. So sort of the guy who actually speaks to the divers from the safety and the dry comfort of the ship, because I've realised that sounds much more pleasant, you know. So yeah, I'm in the process of transferring, but yeah, I've been diving ever since. Yeah.
Oh, amazing! You're a great guy. We ask this at the end of every episode. What's your mantra, Chris? If you have one, what keeps you going? What's some words that you live by?
Well, that's tough. Yeah, our mantra is don't get your umbilical caught at work. That's definitely a mantra.
There you go.
At work. But in terms of life, I don't know. I don't think I don't like to preach, you know. I don't feel, like I said, I don't think I've got much to tell people that they don't already know. But yeah, I mean, it's got to be, you know, life is very, very fragile. You know, I got lucky, but life is extraordinarily fragile. We, you know, there's tragedies every single day. So you really do, cliched as it is, have to live every day as if it's your last in some respects, you know. There's just, with our time. I certainly feel, you know, depends what people feel about the afterlife, but my feeling is that our time and life here, you know, on Earth is very finite, and you've got nothing to lose, so just go for it. Yeah.
I love that. I love your perspective on resilience as well, because we are so resilient as well. And we can get through a lot. Chris, you've been amazing. Last Breath is on Netflix right now. Get yourself on a plane and go and watch it over someone's shoulder as well. Chris, you're an absolute inspiration. Thank you so much for chatting to us.
Yeah, absolute pleasure, Daisy. Thank you so much for having me. It's been it's nice to talk to nice people. So thanks for having me.
And that concludes this episode of Proverbs with Daisy Maskell. That is me. I hope you enjoyed it. Hit subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes, and I will see you soon.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.